The logical question, of course, is why is it still going on the same way? You know, is it something they need, or is it something they don't have the right answer? I mean, do you have thought about that?
Yes, and I've talked about this with military people and intelligence people. Why, if this is a genetic harvest, which is what a consensus is, why would it keep on going for half a century or more? And I've never gotten anybody's definitive answer beyond one person said, if it isn't just genetic harvesting for experimentation, if it's genetic harvesting the way we have food supplies that goes to supermarkets or some constant demand, then you look at that issue of what is a constant demand. And the one thing that's always on the other side of that question for me is something has a survival problem. And if it's that, and we're dealing with not just extraterrestrials zooming around the universe because they can and visiting Earth, that we're dealing with a problem of survival, their survival, our survival, both issues of survival, then suddenly the whole panoply of ongoing animal mutilations for a half a century or more, the human abduction syndrome for at least a half a century, they may be linked, and it may have to do with something survival.
How about human mutilations? I hear every once in a while a story about that. Have you run across any of that?
It's a subject that is one that no one wants to be true. I have heard of cases in Canada and the United States in which humans have been found with the same excisions as animals and no blood and no tracks, but not very many. If we're dealing with thousands of animals globally, of the cases I personally have any knowledge about that would fit into the category of a quote-unquote human mutilation, I don't think that I have ever had knowledge about more than 15 or 16 such cases.
So that it would be an anomaly of some sort. It wouldn't be the normal status of operation.
It's always suggested to me that perhaps whatever this intelligence is that interacts with our planet and is harvesting genetic material from animals is making a distinction between cattle, horses, goats, sheep, pigs, marmots, deer, elk, everything I'm listing have all been subjected to the same exact animal mutilations. But humans seem to be in a different category. I would say that, and I've said this to many ranchers. Sometimes the wife and the children will be very upset, and I've sat across from people eye to eye, and I've said, look, I've been doing this a long time, investigating, and a lot of times I'm on my own. I've walked pastures, I've walked mountains, I've been in many different countries completely on my own. And I'm living proof that if the goal was to just take people out, I would have been gone a long time ago. The ranch communities where mutilations have occurred, sometimes in huge rashes in which there may be 20, 30 mutilations in a couple of months. Not a single person, single family, not any person is ever affected. And that helps people to understand that we're dealing with something. It doesn't take away the incomprehensibility of the animals that are killed in this seemingly gruesome way. But it is helpful for any listener now to realize that something is making a distinction and that humans as a species do not seem to be the focus of anything that I would consider to be violence.
Let's talk briefly about some of the projects you're involved in right now. What's happening in your life professionally?
I got back from England a month ago. I was there for 3 weeks. And it was one of the most fascinating seasons out of the last 13 years. I've been in England for crop formations 10, I think, out of those 13 years.
See, folks, I told you the word crop circles would come to the forefront here.
Oh, it's one of my most favorite subjects, and it's one of the most wonderful adventures of everything I've ever done. Mutilations are repulsive and difficult and very, very difficult to communicate about.
Definitely distasteful.
But when you jump over to crop formations, it's completely different. It's the opposite. They are exciting. The country is exciting. There's always the sense of mystery just around the corner because you never know when one is going to occur. And because these strange, small, mysterious lights, not structured craft are not linked to crop formations. What is linked are these small 6-inch diameter lights that some scientists think are plasmas. What makes them do what they do? I mean, that's the big $64 million question. Are they programmed plasmas by another intelligence that's not even here? Are these some kind of monitoring devices to do work on this planet that are completely out off the radar of current science? I don't know the answers. I just know that these lights have shown up. I've seen them myself. And when you do see them, there is something. Everybody has always said the same words. And because I saw them this summer, you are struck to the point that you're not functioning in a normal way, meaning you can have a camera or a tape recorder, and you can't take your eyes off of what is in front of you. In this case, it was about these four lights were about 100 feet from four of us, or we started as four and a person had gone. There were three looking at these lights. And the beauty of it was so astonishing. And you know that you're in the presence of something that is outside of anything that is normal. And there's nothing threatening. It is exciting and provoking. And when I think of the work that I've done in my life, ranging every year, every month, every week, I am working on a variety of stories in science, medicine, and the environment, and then real X-Files. Well, crop formations certainly are in the category of real X-Files, but they're also in the category of something that is interacting with the environment, leaving physical evidence that I then go to scientists to work on what's in the soil, what's in the plants, what's been deposited, what do we find that are anomalies that can be studied. And you find that in crop formations are some of the most amazing biochemical, biophysical changes that baffle chemists, that baffle biophysicists, that geologists. There's a whole lot of scientists now. Holland, in Germany, in England, in the United States, in Canada, they all see the same data. And they all come to the same conclusion. In some of the formations that are truly mysterious, there are these fundamental changes in the soil and the plants that no one could accomplish with boards, strings, stomper boards, i.e. not hoaxed. That, to me, provokes my mind, my spirit. It is that something, and some people say maybe it's the finger of God. Another man in Holland says maybe it's angels. The hypotheses about what the intelligence could be behind crop formations covers a huge range. Very few people think it's extraterrestrial, interestingly enough. Very few. As if something else in the unseen, that's the key, something in the unseen that has palpable intelligence that manifests itself in the patterns, the geometry, what happens to the plants and the soil. And you know what that does? This is my own personal conclusion. What that does is give me and give the people I know who go out into the field each summer, it gives you hope. Because we are on a planet that is in terrible trouble. There is potential disaster from the environment to the atmosphere to the oceans to the wars, the potential for nuclear holocaust from something like North Korea. We seem to me that I've never felt that I was living in a more dangerous time in my entire life as now. And there is something about the fact that something in the unseen can make these remarkable patterns and leave the physical evidence that can be studied. It stuns a lot of people who study it. And you say, if this can happen now, amid all this chaos on this planet, then maybe something is trying to get our attention and say, you're not totally alone, and what's with you may help you survive.
A definitive message from Linda Moulton Howe, who knows about crop circles. This is Jerry Pippin, and this is the UFO Files.
We'll be back to the UFO Files in a moment. I would like to talk to you about an exciting novel that I recommend that you read. It's based upon real-life incidents of the paranormal and UFO sightings in the backwoods of Maine. It's called River of Fear, written by my good friend Rod Davis out in Las Vegas, Nevada. He spent most of his life in Maine. If you want to know more about the book before you order it, I'd recommend you go over to our website, jerrypippin.com, and click on the UFO Files, and you'll find Rod Davis's picture. And you can click on there, and you can hear interviews with Rod talking about the book. In addition to that, you can read his latest newsletter and see some information and write up about the book itself. It's not available anyplace else except through this radio offer. Now, if you're listening in the continental United States or Alaska or Hawaii, it's 1995. And simply send us a check or money order made out to River of Fear. And if you're outside of the United States, then it's $26.95. We'll pay the shipping. And it's a special radio offer here. Now, once again, I want to give you how to order it. Send a check or money order to Jerry Pippin Show, Post Office Box 800, OKOK, that's OKAY, OK, 744446, 744446. Or you can order it from the website itself by just simply clicking on the picture of Rod Davis.
Linda Moulton Howe, until I saw you today talking about this underwater man-made structures.
Well, that's what we don't know. Megalithic. Now, that's the word that the geologist is using. And this is Dr. Manuel Iturralde. He is a geologist in the Museum of Science in Havana, Cuba. And this story starts back in the summer of 2000. And a woman named Paulina Zelitsky, she's an ocean engineer, grew up in the Soviet Union, very bright, ended up in Havana, assigned in Havana to work on projects there. And then there was a change in the political system, and the Soviet Union basically disintegrated, and it became Russia and what we know today, and her life became freer. And she is married to a man, Paul Weinzweig, who is a Canadian, and therefore she has a Canadian Cuba. She can go back and forth to those countries, but unfortunately she can't come to the United States easily. And she had focused her life with her husband into doing projects that would take advantage of her quite serious professional career as an ocean engineer. And they basically marketed themselves as people who had the kind of ship and equipment that they could go down after shipwrecks, things of an archaeological nature. They had started doing work with the University of Florida in a completely science-related research project. She was, in the summer of 2000, working on a global warming project in which she had been contracted to make measurements, temperature measurements, off the western tip of Cuba. And one day, coming through their side-scan sonar, they weren't looking for anything. It was just part of this project. Here comes an image that just stopped everybody in their tracks. Because on the floor of where they were at the time, which was northeast of what's called Cabo de San Antonio, it's right off the very western tip of the peninsula of Cuba, going straight down a half mile. And there, the bottom is as flat as this floor, white sand, but coming in the side scan sonar, were all these 90-degree angled, very orderly, evenly spaced structures on what appeared to be corridors. And they made several images. and they realized that what they were stumbling upon covered a huge area. They now think that these, and this is the geologist calling them megalithic structures, megalith relating to large carved shaped stones. The era on our planet when there were megalithic structures in Stonehenge, this is the same word is being applied. And why? They got the side scan sonars of what appeared to be structures rising up out of this flat white sand. And they finally, in 2002, they finally got a camera down there that finally got some videotape. And at the conference, I was showing clips from a PowerPoint presentation that Paulina and Paul have produced for various educational and institutional presentations that they've been making. And it is so fascinating because you can see images. You can see the side scan sonar, which is like looking down from an airplane onto the land. You can see a still image, let's say, of a pyramid. Some of the stones are pyramidal shaped. Some seem to be rectangular. But when you see the video and you see the camera move around something that is square on an end, and then as the camera moves, it's like you're moving around the corner of a wall. And one of them is a rectangle that rises into a pyramid. We're talking, as the geologist said, he cannot, as a geologist, see how the shapes that they have down there on video could be made by nature.
So immediately, thoughts of Atlantis come to mind, and so that must mean that Cuba might have been part of Atlantis.
Well, I'll tell you why Atlantis comes to mind. Something that's a half mile down, covering at least 10 square kilometers, it either was once upon a time exactly where it is, and water came in a half mile deep into something, and it was, the water flooded, and we don't know of any dynamic that would do that exactly, or it was up on land somewhere, and something happened, and this whole thing changed elevation for an entire half mile. How long would it take for something like that to happen and still remain in complete structure? If you had something that was cataclysmic and it was 10 square kilometers, it's not going to get to the bottom a half mile deep in one piece. Whatever happened, this is really baffling. And it gets very intriguing when you see the geologists that lay out the data that the western tip of Cuba, the land has nothing to do with the rest of the island. It is a complete and anomalous sort of add-on to Cuba. When geologists began studying these strange anomalies in the island of Cuba, when they started matching soils in any of the surrounding world, which, you know, Miami and Florida is north, Yucatan is to the west, other islands are to the south, the one place, and one place only, that they can find the same kind of clay silica mixture with limestone is the Yucatan. Well, today, between the Yucatan and the western tip of Cuba is all this water. But this is now where, in a way, the story is kind of stalled on this question. If there was a land bridge once upon a time that all of Cuba was hooked, all land going into the Yucatan, and we know that there were settlements on the Yucatan in Mexico that look very similar to these kinds of structures that run in 90 degree angles on long corridors. Whatever happened, it may have been something structured on this land bridge when something cataclysmic did occur and it went down. But when? When did this occur? This to me is one of the most fascinating parts of investigating this story. They know that there are shells that they have been able to get from some of this area where they are investigating that are at least 6,000 years old. From the geologist's point of view, they have to be looking at a time frame that is 6,000 years or older. At 11,000 years to 12,000 years ago, something dramatic and violent happened on the Earth that seemed to be the end of the Ice Age, warming, and caused all of these animals around the world to be found in frozen states with even buttercups in their mouths in some cases. Couldn't that have been the event? Or is it even older? John Anthony West thinks the Sphinx is 36,000 years old. Other scientists I've talked to are convinced, even though they can't say it publicly, because it is politically too unacceptable, that there appears to be evidence around the planet in which megalithic stone builders from Great Britain to Egypt to South America, Central America, Mesoamerica were building in large stone structures 40,000 years ago. Are we facing in off the western tip of Cuba another one of these sort of doors that's opening up to another reality in the history of this planet, that it won't be long before Sumeria is no longer the cutting off point of so-called civilization, and we are finally moving to a point where the real truth will be that there have been cycles of civilizations on this planet. Sumeria and where we are now simply being the most current one. And perhaps at the time of whatever these great, great civilizations were that predated Egypt, Sumeria, and so forth, they were greater, and they may have been the product of cohabitation by a non-human intelligence with humans on this planet in a teaching role and a employment role of humans, teaching humans, but having humans do work for them. That might explain everything.
Mind-boggling theory. Linda Moten Howe, always a pleasure, and we'll continue to follow your career. I'm sure you'll be opening some more doors.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm glad I've been here, and onward with more Earth Mysteries.
Thank you very much. Linda Moten Howe, always a pleasure having her on the show. Hey, we've really enjoyed our days here at Laughlin at Harrah's, and we recommend the next time I have a UFO conference of any sort, you try to get there if you are a UFO regular, because you'll really enjoy it. They always get into much more depth than in the presentations than we do here on the air. I'd like to thank everybody at Harrah's for a wonderful time. And we'll be back here in Laughlin again in February, broadcasting the annual UFO conference and film festival. And, of course, that'll be down the street at the Flamingo. I'd like to thank Sue Hansen, our technical person tonight, for helping us put together another great show. And Larry Dickin, our UFO Files producer. Check us out on the web, won't you, at jerrypippin.com. Until next time, cheers.